All right, if everybody would, have your Bible open to Psalm 16. And remember that we've set out on a study on what I've called the Christ Psalms, what you'll hear referred to sometimes as the Messianic Psalms. And these prayers and songs of the Old Testament, or of Israel in the Old Testament days, turn out to be the basis, the vehicle for understanding what God has done for us through His Son. The early church found in the phrases of these Psalms especially a way of understanding what had occurred. When the Spirit inspired or guided the apostles in announcing or communicating what God had done in the world through His Son, they often used the phrases that were drawn from these great passages. And one of the striking things to me about it is that these would be passages that would be easy to read through and overlook the idea that they might somehow be talking about Jesus, or they might be talking about the Messiah. And yet when the apostles get up and announce it, and you look at it, you see, well, yeah, I can see what that was about at the time. Now, I've suggested that one of the ways these songs can bless us is in trying to equip ourselves with the phraseology for prayer and for worship, and also for gratitude in responding to what God has done for us. And also, I would point out again that these psalms often are talking about the King of Israel, who's representative of all of the people. And especially with David, and in view of the covenant that God made with David in 2 Samuel 7. And in that way, they are representative of the Christ and how he stands for all of us in heaven as our mediator with God. So in that way, there is a kind of a double representation here. Now, Psalm 16. Is the second one of these in our series, and I don't know if I'm odd in this way, but it helps me to find out that God used the songs that were from the ordinary experiences of people to be the ones that he drew the pictures of Christ from. I think that reminds me that the life changing things that go on may not be the things that happen at really remarkable places in our lives, but just in everyday trying to live for the Lord, and you'll see that in this passage here. I want to mention to you that in this psalm, there are two statements that are used in two places in the New Testament, that are cited in two places in the New Testament, and both of them are in conjunction with the passage we read last week from Psalm 2. I think that's interesting. Verse 8 and following here is cited in the first, remember, the first public proclamation of what the death and the resurrection of Jesus meant, Acts 2, verses 25 through 28. That's in verse 8. And then Paul's first recorded sermon in Acts 13 in Antioch of Pisidia. You notice that verse 10 is cited, Acts 13, verse 35. Maybe you noticed that in your reading. So that tells you something of this passage. Now, what the passage is about, what the song is about, is taking refuge in God. And I want to kind of title our studies that day in that way. In you I take refuge is what the idea is about. What does it mean to you to take refuge in something, whatever it might be? If you take refuge, what does that mean?
Safekeeping.
All right, safekeeping. This is where I go for safekeeping. When we were kids and we played tag or whatever it was, we had a base. If we played baseball, we got on base. If we had contact with the base, we were all right. As time went by, we formed friendships and associations, or maybe we felt safe in our homes, or maybe we found out that God is the proper refuge for any of us. And that's what Psalm 16 is about. Now, it has three parts to it. At least I outline it this way in my mind. There is a past, present, and future part of this psalm. Now, in the first four verses, if you notice, we can read it and think about especially what it has meant in the past for him to decide to take refuge in the Lord. All right, and I want to mention. I mention it this way and say that taking refuge means, first off, that God is the one who preserves me. Everybody see this? In verse 1, just look at it. Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. To take refuge in God is to turn to him to be the one who preserves you, to depend on him for your care and keeping, to depend on him for your protection, to depend on him to be the one who maintains your life and who keeps you safe. Usually, the idea of using this word would mean that there have been some things around that put in question whether you would be preserved. Something you need to be preserved from. For David, what might some of those things have been? For any of us, what might they be? All right, enemies. Obviously, with David especially, they were ever present. The enemy of Israel was an enemy of David. He had to deal with enemies ranging from Saul to all of Saul's associates, and then all of the other enemies around. Several of the Psalms tell us about how he felt about people who were watching for him, who were talking about him, who were threatening him, who were plotting against him, who were, you know, all those kind of things. So, what besides enemies?
Well, I think the influence of Satan, because at one time, because of Satan's influence, he wanted to count Israel. So.
All right, and did, and it caused a great agony in a lot of ways. Can you think of some other things?
Just the strength to lead the nation in God's will.
All right. The to do the right thing is in terms of being responsible for a whole people. We haven't mentioned just things like disease, sickness, death, discouragement, all kinds of things like that. And where do people commonly turn for someone to preserve them? What do people expect will preserve them from all of those things? See, this is not as simple a thing as you might first think. Just turn to God and he'll preserve you. What do we turn to preserve us? All right, the wisdom or the learning of other people, or the power, the strength of other people. What else?
Doctors.
Yes.
Ourselves.
We're going to take care of ourselves. Money. right? Possessions, power, all of the kinds of things that people still turn to were at work here. Then notice, I think from verse 2, it's interesting. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. Now, what's not immediately obvious in this passage to us is the name the Lord. How many of you, do you notice in verse 2 the first mention of the word Lord is in capitals in most English versions? You see that? There are two different words for Lord used here. The first one is the word that in some of the versions of the Bible will be translated Jehovah. Some of the versions be translated Yahweh. This is the way God introduced himself to Moses at the burning bush. And it meant that this is the I am. This is I am who I am. This is the living God who will do what he will be what he will be. And he has life in himself. And he's the God of Israel and the one who made a covenant with Israel. This other word for Lord means you are my owner or master or ruler. So David has said to the living God, the God of Israel, you are my owner. I give myself to you. To take refuge in God means not just that you turn to him for protection, but you actually submit to him as your ruler, which is an important thought. Number three, look in verse 3 here, and he says here, I have no good apart from you. I should, at the end of verse 2, not verse 3, but I have no good apart from you. I'm going to combine this with the end of verse 3, but you are the one I delight in. In other words, this is not, he says, I have no good apart from you. You are the source of all the good in my life. And if you combine it with the end of verse 3, the idea of delight enters the picture as well. God is not just a fire escape, not just an emergency exit, not just someone to hide behind, but God is actually the one that David wants to be around. He wants to be with. He wants the company, the fellowship of the Lord. And you'll notice in a lot of David's Psalms that he wants to be at God's house. He looks forward to the idea of worship. And then the other one, the other idea is in verse 3 that the saints, all the saints in the land are his excellent ones. I want to paraphrase it just a little bit. The saints are my heroes. What does it mean to be a saint? You guys know the meaning of this term. Go ahead and say it. Saint means?
Child of God.
All right, a child of God, a holy one. Someone who is set apart, who belongs to the Lord. Someone who is holy to the Lord. You might admire the wicked who do their own thing, watch out for themselves, live it up, and get away with it. Or you might admire the godly who at sacrifice or cost to themselves served and devote themselves to doing right and so forth. And David says, taking refuge in the Lord means I admire the others who belong to the Lord, I delight in their fellowship. They give me a sense of well-being. And you put those four things together, and that's in the past what it has already meant for David to take refuge in the Lord. Look at this last one especially, and without any names, think about who you're... If you are a taker of refuge in the Lord, Who have you respected? Who has been your hero? What kind of ways have the saints been your excellent ones? Can you think of some in your past? Can you? What kind of people were they?
I remember when I came to church, they made me feel like I was special.
All right. I can think of some people over my time, even with this congregation, who've had exactly that effect on me, too. Yeah, yeah. Anybody else? What kind of people have they been? And how have they been related to your taking refuge in the Lord?
Good examples.
All right, examples to imitate.
People who have had dire trials in their life and how faithful they remain.
They're
usually stronger than those who have a smooth road.
And that sends a message to the rest of us, first of humility. We may think I don't have much to complain about. And then second, you respect the endurance. You respect the faith that can stay with something and remain positive through it. And still, a lot of them have tried to go on helping people, and their faith, instead of decreasing because they have such a struggle, it seems to grow. And I've seen so many people like that. And I think of the ones that I've known. Who try to serve, and they're not the ones who want somebody to do for them. They're the ones who are always doing something for others, and that we shouldn't take lightly the role that other people who take refuge in the Lord have in our taking refuge in the Lord, in the sense of well-being we gain from them in that way. All right, you see, if you think of this, that this psalm does not have in mind just finding a hole and hiding somewhere. God is not that, but this is a person living in real life, depending on the Lord, living under His rule, finding good in Him, and having the saints as His excellent ones. Now, once that has happened, once that kind of relationship or commitment has existed in the past, He's God, I belong to Him, then what kind of thing does that create in the present? Well, look at verses 5 and following for a second. Verses 4 and following for a second. I probably should have included 4 with what we've just studied. But David mentions that he has shied away from any worship of another god. Verse 4, the sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. In other words, his loyalty to God excludes any other god. But now, he uses in verses 5 and 6 for his present 3 phrases that I think are interesting. Verse 5, the Lord is, look at first, my chosen portion. And I'm going to write all 3 of these up here for us to see, and then we'll talk about them a bit. And then, and my cup. And then, you hold my lot. What does this mean now? What is he saying here? I'm interested in these three phrases. All of them have one thing in common, and that thing is that they're related to the way the land, the promised land, was divided up once the people went into the land. You might remember the land was marked off, and we would say surveyed, I suppose, in our modern language, but they did it by by casting off or by casting lots under God's instruction, and we would call that maybe drawing straws or something like that. And then the land got divided up into blocks for tribes and then family possessions. And those parcels of land were a family's portion. Okay? Now, what kind of portion, for example, did the families from the tribe of Levi get? What was their inheritance or portion?
Cities within the lots.
All right. They had 48 cities that were scattered around throughout the land, and they got the cities and then the areas right around the city where they could grow food and that kind of thing. But no territory, no block of land, because their lot or portion was to represent the people and service to God in the tabernacle and then the temple. And this became their sustenance, their cup, their part in life. And David is saying it's almost as if the illustration is that David has gotten to choose his own inheritance in the land, and that his the cup that he wants to drink, what his life is all about, is service to God, and he believes that God holds his entire destiny, his entire inheritance in his hand. Now, I'm taking time to on these two parts of the psalm for an important reason. His past, I mean, it looks like a wonderful thing. God preserves him. God's his Lord. He delights in the saints. He won't serve any other God. And now, what this means to him is verse 6, the lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. Those are wonderful statements, but it's like he considers himself to be most fortunate in the way the lots have caused the lines to fall, the property lines, and his portion, he thinks, is the best of all. All right, now, that leads us to the part of this psalm that gets used in the New Testament. And this, we're down at verse 7 now. I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. What's the first way in which God relates to him here? He's his counselor. He's his instructor, his advisor. In the night also my heart instructs me. That's like saying when I can't sleep, I remember what God has done for me and I think about what he has said and I consider my obligation to him, and I learn. What do you do with your sleepless nights? Do you count your worries? Do you count sheep? do you get up and watch TV? Do you count the ways that God has blessed you? I have set the Lord always before me, verse 8. Because he's at my right hand, I shall not be shaken. Now, there's the part where the New Testament begins to touch us here. Was David always successful in that statement in verse 8? I've set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken.
No.
Some of the other psalms indicate the times when he wavered with that. If you were to read Psalms 42, 43, you'll notice He has to say to his soul, ask his soul why there are, paraphrasing it a bit here, why it's shaken. No. Why it's cast down. And that is the human part of this, of the experience. And then there are times when tragedies have happened to him, and he's had to cry out to God. And there are several of the Psalms that are about those situations. And then there are the times when he has let himself down, and he has to talk about his repentance and his grief. And that's a real part of this. So how are these the grand intention and the real human experience to be reconciled? That's first question. Then verse 9. Therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. Consider that last statement. My flesh also dwells secure. One of the oldest parts of the Bible is the Psalm of Moses in Psalm 90, in which it describes flesh being like grass that withers and the flower that falls or fades away. It's the one where we may live the 70 or if by reason of strength 80. But all those years are soon gone and we fly away. Did David not know that? When he said, my flesh dwells secure, did he not know that no flesh dwells secure? Did David not expect ever to die? Had he not seen disease or aging or accidents or assassination attempts or attacks? How can flesh ever dwell secure? That's the second question that comes up. And then there's this statement. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. What is Sheol? This is the ESV reading. What do the other versions say there? The realm of the dead. Sheol is the realm of the dead. Sheol is the Hebrew rough equivalent to Hades, the Greek term in the New Testament. It means the unseen or the world or the world beyond this, almost like the grave or the pit. You'll hear it referred to that way. Or you won't abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. Now consider that statement. How much of this did David realize? In your presence there is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures evermore. Alright? Now what about the statements there that David makes? I won't be shaken, my flesh dwells secure, you won't let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. Where do those statements find their ultimate fulfillment? How does God answer them? Look at Acts 2 to start with. All right, we got just a couple minutes and we'll finish this here. Acts chapter 2. And notice that David's words are used as the proof text for Peter's announcement that God raised Jesus up, loosing the pangs of death because it wasn't possible for him to be holding of it. Look at verse 25 through 28. Brendan, read for us, please.
For David says of him, I saw the Lord always in my presence, for he is at my right hand, so that I will not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue exulted. Moreover, my flesh will also live in hope, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence.
All right, now does everybody see that is the Greek version of the end of Psalm 16? Everybody sees that? Peter is quoting from the psalm that we just read. And he is saying that the surprise is that God has fulfilled what David said by raising up Jesus. And that David was not talking just about himself. Look at verse 25. For David says concerning him. So in Jesus, our representative in heaven, our man in our man in heaven, these sayings of David find their true and ultimate fulfillment, right? That's the claim of the New Testament. Peter's argument is, brothers, I may say to you with confidence that the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of Christ, that he has not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up. So Peter's argument, the apostle's argument is, that these phrases have been literally fulfilled, but in the person of Jesus. And that David foresaw this. Not that David, remember in 1 Peter 1, we learned that the prophets inquired what they were speaking of. They didn't understand all the implications of it. But this is how God fulfilled it. He takes a person's hope for this continuing experience in a world which is passing away, and he makes it real through the resurrection of Christ and offers us a place in that. Look at Acts 13 now, real quickly. In Acts 13, remember he quotes in verse 33, Psalm 2 and verse 7. And look at verse 35 now. Becky, read for us, please.
Therefore, he also says in another psalm, thou wilt not allow thy holy one to undergo decay.
All right, now that's, you won't let your holy one see corruption. That's from Psalm 16, as we just read. Go ahead, Becky.
For David, after he had served the purpose of God in his own generation, fell asleep and was laid among his fathers and underwent decay.
All right, so David's flesh was not secure in the sense that he never would experience death and so forth, but well, go ahead, verse 37.
But he whom God raised did not undergo decay. Therefore, let it be known to you, brethren, that through him the forgiveness of sin is proclaimed to you.
All right, now David, remember, Jesus is a son of David, and so by raising him up, God did not allow his Holy One to see corruption. And he blessed both David that way, as well as confirming that Jesus is the promised one, and he offers us the covenant blessings in him. All right, in a roundabout way, I hope that we take a look at this and see how God fulfills and sustains hope in this promise to David, and how he fulfills it in Christ, and he offers us an inheritance that's incorruptible and undefiled and fades not away, as 1 Peter 1, verses 3 and 4 teaches, in Christ. Thank you guys for being with us. Good to have you folks here. Everybody have a week that remains interesting each day, and I hope you have some time to stop and think about the Lord as we've been reading.
What song are we going to stay next week?
22 next week, yes. Thanks, Gene. Everybody be with us. Ken.